Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1400 hours GMT on Friday the 15th of March, these are our main stories. Russian voters are taking part in a presidential election which Vladimir Putin is bound to win. The first ship carrying aid to Gaza since the start of the current conflict has arrived off the coast of the territory. The leaders of Germany, France and Poland are meeting in Berlin, hoping to agree on how to aid Ukraine. Also in this podcast...
You can see there's now a second generation of artists who've taken up Keith Haring, and you can't really force that.
Before there was Banksy, Keith Haring was a pioneer of graffiti art. A new biography reflects on a life cut short. We start in Russia, where 3 days of voting in the country's presidential election is underway. The result is a foregone conclusion and will confirm yet another six-year presidential term for Vladimir Putin, his fifth. The elections are being held at a time when Russia is making headway in its invasion of Ukraine. I asked Vitaly Shevchenko, our Russia analyst from BBC Monitoring, how the Russian authorities ensure the result.
One way is making sure there are no credible challenges to Vladimir Putin, but also the people who are on the commissions which count the votes, a lot of them, well, they represent the government. And earlier the BBC spoke to a member of one such commission who we cannot name, and he described how this works.
In my commission, there was no signs of forging the results, but there were some manipulations on the previous elections in 2018. We had more than 100 people on our polling station that do not live in this area. They have special paper that they can vote, and they were definitely working for government in public sector, like teachers, medical workers, military, police, and so on. Nobody did stand behind their shoulder while they were putting marks in the ballots. Their number was enough to change the results.
So this man, he seems to be unrelated to the government, but he says that there are people on these commissions who make sure that the correct sort of result is obtained. But if you look at the ballot this time, there are four candidates. It's very obvious that one of them, Vladimir Putin, is towering head and shoulders above the other three. And he's engineered this absolutely bleak and barren political landscape where there are no serious or realistic contenders who could oust him, kick him out of the Kremlin, because all of the most popular and most vocal opponents of Vladimir Putin, they are in exile, in jail, or dead.
So as you point out, there is no effective opposition. What are the main concerns of Russians? I mean, does the war or the special operation, as Vladimir Putin calls it, does that worry them?
They are worried, given how many Russians have been killed. But the people who do not necessarily agree with Vladimir Putin's policies, they do not have a way of expressing their discontent, because the moment they become too vocal or too popular, they're fined, they're jailed, or worse. So because of this, the number of Russians who oppose the war is really difficult to estimate, and they have to quietly mumble their discontent. And this is precisely the situation that Vladimir Putin, being a former KGB officer, is very happy to see.
Given that his win is inevitable, why are they so keen to hold these elections?
Well, the truth is that very few authoritarian or strongman leaders are happy to be called authoritarian. They need this ritual of revalidation or anointment or a way of legitimizing their continued rule. And this is one big reason why these elections are being held over 3 days. to make it easier to make sure that turnout numbers are pretty high. In occupied parts of Ukraine, voting started on the 25th of February. The Kremlin can say, well, look, so many people have voted. They want Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin.
Vitaly Shevchenko. We've previously reported on this podcast about the journey of the first ship carrying supplies directly to Gaza. Now that vessel has been seen off the coast of the territory. The Spanish ship has been able to travel there through a new maritime corridor. With the war now in its 6th month, there are reports that Palestinians are starving. A displaced Palestinian, Abu Issa Ibrahim Filfil, said he was waiting to meet the vessel so that aid and food could be distributed.
I want the aid for my children. I want them to live and not die of hunger. There's no bread. All they're eating is wild plants. I mean, this is the month of Ramadan, and there's nothing. Inshallah, they will bring food for the children. That's all we ask.
I spoke to our Middle East editor, Mike Thompson, and asked him how far this aid will go.
To give you some idea, Val, if you think that this has got 200 tonnes of food aid in that ship, on the barge that it's towing anyway, and apparently, according to the UN figures, WFP figures, a truck can take 30 tonnes of aid. So that's less than 7 trucks worth, which is actually on this barge. And while, of course, as we were hearing then, every bit of aid is so desperately needed. But nonetheless, this won't go far.
And once you get the aid in, once the barge arrives at the newly built dock, getting it around Gaza, that's going to be a huge logistical challenge, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. I mean, first of all, we're not even sure that the jetty has been completed yet, the sort of makeshift jetty to unload the stuff from the barges. And then, of course, you've got the fact that there's still fighting going on, so it's going to be a very torturous job trying to get the aid to where it's needed without the trucks being hit. And, of course, there's so many desperate people, as we were hearing from the man just a little earlier, and many trucks have been looted. So we haven't heard what the plan is there. Hamas won't want to be on the trucks guarding them, because they would fear they'd be shot at by Israeli forces. So it's really unclear what's going to happen, how it's going to get to where it's supposed to go.
And really, should the focus be on getting aid in through land? We've had the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, you know, saying, why are hundreds of thousands of people, including children, dying of malnutrition? And he's saying Israel is blocking aid.
Now, Israel denies that and says the problems are more down to the UN and its distribution system. But the UN says many trucks get held up for long periods due to the inspections and that many of them are refused entry. Palestinian Red Crescent staff have said that if there's a particular item on board a truck that the Israelis don't want to go through, the whole truck gets turned back and they're not told what the item is. That was one claim they've been making. When you think that prior to this, around 500 trucks a day would go into Gaza.
500 trucks a day.
Indeed. And now we've just got a trickle going in. It's still just a very small amount compared to what's needed.
Mike Thompson. As Russians head to the polls, officials in the Ukrainian city of Odessa say at least 14 people have been killed in Russian missile attacks on a residential area. Our correspondent in Kyiv is Sarah Rainsford.
Well, these are numbers that are coming from the Ukrainian Rescue Service and also from the local governor, the military administration in Odessa. They're saying that 14 people have been killed, some 46 people have been injured, including rescue workers. Now, what they're saying is that there was a rocket that hit some residential buildings and some civilian infrastructure, as they've described it. A gas pipe was on fire, and that when rescue workers went to the area to try to put out the fire and to help people at the scene, there was a second rocket that hit. So it is a very significant number of people who are dead and injured after this attack. And obviously, you know, that there is concern also about those injuries. We know that some of the medics who were injured and the rescuers who were injured are in a fairly serious condition.
Meanwhile, the leaders of Germany, France and Poland are meeting in Berlin as part of plans to show a more unified front in their support for Ukraine. Our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, told us more.
What this meeting is being widely read as is an effort to pull these three countries together, but particularly address some tensions that have become increasingly evident and spilling out into the public domain between France and Germany. Of course, two key countries, key economies in Europe, and it's widely seen in Europe that it's really necessary for them to get on. But there's lots of reports that Emmanuel Macron, the French president, and Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, haven't actually got a very good relationship. And as I say, you have sort of seen that spill out into the public in terms of their positioning on Ukraine. You'll remember not long ago, Emmanuel Macron wouldn't rule out the idea of sending troops into Ukraine. Now, some people said this is like strategic ambiguity, but Olaf Scholz was very quick to jump in and say, absolutely not, that is not going to happen. He really made a point of it. And then there's been a bit of back and forth between the two countries and figures in and around the government about who's doing more or who's doing better to supply crucial weapons to Ukraine. So a lot of people seeing today's meeting as perhaps an effort to try and smooth out that relationship, along with Poland's Donald Tusk coming here as well. But the first meeting will be a bilateral between Emmanuel Macron and Olaf Scholz, obviously all behind closed doors.
And is anything concrete going to come out of it at the end?
Well, I think in terms of any kind of solid announcement, no, that's certainly not what we're expecting. I suppose from a diplomatic point of view, if the two men did get their relationship on a better footing, and if they could just start to communicate in a slightly more coordinated manner, then that would be seen, I think, from the French government's perspective as a concrete win for them, because what's been happening is they have been striking different tones on Ukraine as well. Emmanuel Macron, we heard it again last night, increasingly hawkish. And there's lots of theories as to why that might be. Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, often kind of striking this more cautious tone, saying and really emphasising Germany is not a war party in terms of this conflict in Ukraine after the Russian invasion. But I think the two sides will be hoping that they can start to coordinate their messaging a little bit better, because, of course, it's very much thought that the Kremlin will always celebrate if there is an evident division or a divided message coming out of key countries in the West.
Jessica Parker. Water has become a weapon in this war. When the Kakhovka Dam in Russian-controlled southern Ukraine was destroyed last June, it unleashed a flood, causing long-term damage to Ukraine's agricultural sector, with both sides blaming each other for the act. The dispute over water between Russia and Ukraine was reignited when Russia annexed Crimea back in 2014. But the roots of the row go all the way back to the Soviet era. Crassy Twig from BBC Monitoring has more.
It's 1950. Top Soviet leaders joined a gathering for the grand opening of the North Crimea Canal, built to bring water from the Dnipro River to semi-arid North Crimea.
The North Crimean Canal is one of the longest ones in the whole world. It's the longest in Europe.
This is Sergei Arsentiev from BBC Monitoring's Kyiv team.
Ukraine had to pay for the project of Soviet gigantomania.
2,000 villages were permanently flooded, with around 3 million people forced from their homes. The remolding of the Crimean landscape as part of a Soviet grand design was prompted by a change in the demographics of the region. After the Red Army won Crimea back from the Third Reich in 1944, an unprecedented crackdown took place. Francis Carr is a Russian media analyst with BBC Monitoring.
Stalin accused the native population of Crimea, the Tatars, of collaborating with Nazi Germany and embarked on a policy of forced deportation to Central Asia. In their place came huge numbers of ethnic Russians, completely changing the social fabric of the peninsula.
Russians were accustomed to growing potatoes and cabbage, and they needed water.
The North Crimean Canal had supplied the peninsula with 85% of its water needs. However, only a small proportion of this was actually drinking water. The vast majority of it was meant for irrigation.
Fast forward to 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea, Moscow found itself in a bizarre situation: to be dependent on Kyiv for the water supply of Ukrainian territory it had just occupied. Sergei again.
Ukraine continued to supply water along the canal until April 2014, but Crimea refused to pay for that water, and after a considerable debt accumulated, Ukraine cut off water.
Francis has looked into Moscow's response.
Inside Russia, we actually saw attempts to downplay the significance of lack of water supplies. And this is a topic which President Putin has been very reluctant to discuss publicly, which suggests that he wants ordinary Russians to think it's not a particularly large problem.
But the message aimed at audiences abroad couldn't be more different.
Russia, on international platforms, has accused Ukraine of genocide and of hypocrisy, saying that if it really cares about the people of Crimea, it wouldn't have taken this step.
Under the Geneva Convention, the occupying country, Russia in this case, should provide food and water for the population of the occupied territory. Russia launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, and Francis remembers one of its first major acts.
The Russian army blew up the dam that Ukraine had built to stop water supplies reaching Crimea just 2 days into the invasion. And that suggests, to me at least, that this was a key objective in attacking Ukraine.
Crimean TV channels reported live from the scene when water started filling the concrete canal bed, weeks after the start of the full-scale invasion.
Russia presented the restoration of water supply to Crimea as the biggest victory of the invasion.
16 months later, the next major act of destruction of Ukraine's water infrastructure followed, the breach of the Nova Kakhovka Dam in the summer of 2023.
Ukrainian experts estimated that about 15% of Ukrainian grain export potential was lost. They say that there will be no irrigated agriculture there in the next decade.
Crassy Twig. And you can hear more on this week's edition of the Jigsaw podcast from BBC Monitoring. Now, before there was Banksy and Shepherd Fairey, there was Keith Haring. The American artist died more than 30 years ago, but his pop art, which emerged from New York in the 1980s, has had a huge impact on the modern art world. Brad Gooch is the author of a new biography of Haring entitled Radiant.
So there is always music going on. There's always a boombox playing. Madonna very much came up with Keith Haring at the same time, and she would sleep on his couch. He would have yearly parties for life. At the first one, Madonna performed Like a Virgin. He was also very close with Grace Jones, who was a great Paradise Garage figure. And he painted her body. The painted body of Grace Jones was then photographed by Robert Mapplethorpe, appeared in Andy Warhol's Interview magazine. Keith was very much an activist, fighting against the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and 1984. He used his art for gay liberation. And later, when he's diagnosed as being HIV positive, he becomes very much an activist, coming out publicly in Rolling Stone as a PWA, a person with AIDS. You can see there's now a second generation of artists who've taken up Keith Haring, and you can't really force that. I'm thinking of artists like Banksy who are doing these public, edgy, political messaging, anti-war, anti-violence, or Shepherd Fairey who did the Hope poster for the Obama campaign in 2008, Nelson Mandela mural in Johannesburg. All of this shows Keith's vision.
Brad Gooch, author of a new biography on artist Keith Haring, who died at the age of 31 in 1990. Still to come on this podcast.
Who wants a woman of 50 to be sweet anyway?
We peek inside the diaries of women writing over the past 400 years.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
Now, will a solution worked out for Haiti by its fellow CARICOM or Caribbean Community members and their superpower neighbour, the United States, succeed? Encouraged by CARICOM, Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry resigned on Monday and a new transitional council is due to be set up. One of the Caribbean's most distinguished diplomats, Sir Ronald Sanders, is the ambassador of Antigua and Barbuda to the United States. He led a delegation in 2016 that resolved a previous constitutional crisis in Haiti. He spoke to James Copnell, who asked him, will the forthcoming transitional council make a difference?
Well, it depends on how soon we get that transitional council going. At the moment, it's in deep trouble because some of the organizations who were supposed to contribute to the composition of seven members of the council have already reneged from it. One of them has described it as a waste of time. Another has put up a candidate that's unacceptable. The private sector themselves are not able to decide on who their candidate will be. So it's not by any means certain that this council will be established quickly.
Where do you estimate then that the problems are coming from? Is it in part that this is seen as a sort of imposed solution on Haitian affairs, or is it down more to the divisiveness and personal ambitions perhaps within Haiti's political scene?
Well, I think it's more of the latter than the former. It's always been difficult to get the political parties and other entities in Haiti to agree to anything that lasts. If you look at the experience, for instance, of the Prime Minister who's just been asked to resign, Ariel Henry, he was involved in three different agreements over the time that he was Prime Minister, and all of them unraveled. Because of the political rivalry that exists, it's been very difficult for the political leadership in Haiti to set aside their own political ambitions, their desire for power, in order to empower Haiti. They are more intent on becoming the leader than in leading Haiti.
What happens then if this transitional council doesn't get formed?
Well, I suppose some kind of transitional council will have to be put in place, maybe with those who have submitted names and said that they're in agreement with the council. It won't be a transitional council of seven. It'll have to be a transitional council of those who have agreed to participate in it. But setting up a transitional council is one thing. Actually beginning to administer Haiti is quite another, because the truth of the matter is that the gangs are still very much in control of the place.
Sir Ronald Sanders speaking to James Copnell. In the United States, experts are warning that suicide rates in young people are becoming a national epidemic. Last year saw the highest number of suicides on record in the country, with the previous high reached in 2022. Experts have warned the rate is particularly high on college campuses. The BBC's North America correspondent Will Vernon went to North Carolina to investigate, a warning that some listeners may find his report upsetting.
So that's a gold medal.
A talented student, an aspiring Olympian, a loving son and partner. 21-year-old Ben Salas appeared to have a promising future. But his parents tell me they had no idea their son was living a double life.
One life he was planning his suicide, and the other life he was planning his engagement.
Ben took his own life after sending his parents a suicide note by text message. The question Catherine and Tony Salas are now trying to answer is why.
There weren't any of the typical indicators that you would expect. He wasn't withdrawn.
He was really special. And it really, I quit my job. One of the buildings I used to go to was actually where I got the text.
Ben had briefly received treatment for mild depression 3 years ago, but he told his parents he'd fully recovered. In the previous academic year, seven students, including Ben, took their own lives at North Carolina State University. So far this academic year, there have been three suicides.
It's a national epidemic here in the United States.
Justine Hollingshead is Assistant Vice Chancellor at NC State.
If we could figure out the why, we would certainly solve the problem. So it's not something that we're trying to avoid or not figure out. But I do feel like we're doing the very best we can in unimaginable circumstances.
In response to the deaths, NC State has increased the number of counsellors and brought in new measures to identify those who may be struggling. Staff are trained to refer students who are regularly skipping lectures or deadlines. Students here tell me the suicides have shocked the community.
A lot of kids our age have anxiety about, like, the world in general.
They're putting more of an emphasis on faculty who are aware of the problems and how to help students with mental health problems.
This suicide crisis isn't just an issue for North Carolina State. There's nothing about this university that sets it apart from any other. In fact, there have been similar situations with multiple youth suicides right across the country. No one really knows for sure why exactly this is happening.
The pandemic caused a significant hit on our young people.
Dr. Christine Crawford, a psychiatrist from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, says COVID could be partly responsible for the mental health crisis.
They were at home, disconnected from their peers, from all of the elements that are so critical for healthy development in a young person.
And Dr. Crawford says modern lifestyle habits can have a negative impact on social interaction.
They're growing up in the world in which I imagine they're thinking, oh, the world is burning down, everyone is angry, it's awful, it's awful. They're seeing this play out each and every day on their phones.
I wear it over my heart because that's where Ben is. He's in my heart.
Back at the Salas family home, Catherine shows me the badge she wears every day with her son's face on it.
Don't settle for I'm okay. I mean, I talked to Ben a couple of hours before we got the text message.
Because an okay may be an okay, but an okay a lot of times is not.
That report from Will Vernon. If you are suffering distress or despair and need support, details of help available in the UK can be found at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Help and support outside the UK can be found at Befrienders Worldwide. In Japan, medical experts are warning about a rare but dangerous bacterial infection that's spreading across the country at an alarming rate. I heard more from reporter Lipika Pelham.
Japan's health officials are racing against time to identify the cause of this disease. It's a rare but dangerous bacterial infection which is spreading at a record rate. Streptococcal toxic shock syndrome is a deadly form of group A disease, and it was confirmed in Japan last year, and it's been spreading fast. It's a highly virulent and infectious strain of disease. It can cause serious illnesses. Health officials said that it can cause... The symptoms include sudden and severe cough and meningitis-like syndrome symptoms and pneumonia and tonsillitis, and it can also lead to organ failure.
And it's particularly serious, isn't it, for older people?
Yes, Japan's health officials are again saying, especially National Institute of Infectious Diseases, the complications happen particularly in adults over 30, and about 30% of the cases are fatal.
So what are the authorities doing to try to combat this?
They're recommending that people must take the basic hygiene precautions against this streptococcal toxic shock syndrome as they did during COVID pandemic, i.e. you keep your fingers and hands clean, exercise cough etiquette, and also make sure that you wear mask and don't go out to congested places, public places, and try and kind of keep clean. That's mainly the, you know, the basic instruction or advice that's coming from the health ministry.
Is there a global concern over this?
At the moment, no, because provisional figures released by the health ministry recorded 940 cases of this disease last year. And in the first 2 months of this year, 378 cases have been recorded. But so far, all the infections are within Japan, and it hasn't been reported anywhere else so far.
Lipika Pelham. And finally, do you keep a diary? And if so, why and who for? These are just some of the themes explored in what's been billed as the first comprehensive anthology of female diarists. It's called Secret Voices, A Year of Women's Diaries. It features entries from over the past four centuries, from women like the writer and conservationist Beatrix Potter to the TV host Oprah Winfrey. Here's an excerpt from the account of a 1940s housewife in England, Nella Last, reflecting on her relationship with her husband.
He told me rather wistfully that I was not so sweet since I'd been working down at the centre, and I said, well, who wants a woman of 50 to be sweet anyway? And besides, I suit me a lot better.
The historical biographer who compiled them, Sarah Gristwood, reading there. And Claire MacDonald spoke to her.
Are you really talking just to yourself, or are you stretching out a hand in the dark? A lot of these women were putting down feelings that they couldn't voice openly in past centuries, but maybe they wished they could.
There's lots of situations where these incredibly competent, talented women are getting the male brush off.
Exactly. No, Beatrix Potter kept a diary in code for many of the early years of her life. Now, the diary stopped when she began to move out into the world and become successful. She began to do these, Beatrix Potter, these drawings of fungi, massively respected now. But in her day, she went to show them to the director of Kew, who was just, brushing her off. And Beatrix wrote, it's very frustrating for a shy person to be treated as if they were conceited, especially when the shy person happens to be right.
What a great put down. Is there anyone you've discovered in this huge research project, anyone high profile, that's changed your perception of them?
Quite a lot. I mean, the classic example, which many of us probably do know, is Queen Victoria writing after her wedding night, about how Albert had come in to put her stockings on for her and how wonderful he looked in skin-tight breeches with nothing underneath them. But Virginia Woolf, who we've mentioned, we all know her as a writer, a diarist, Bloomsbury. Who'd have guessed that she had a passion for cars? That she wrote, I know, Virginia Woolf is a petrol head.
That's brilliant.
And there's people I didn't even know, like Ada Blackjack, the souls of Inuit woman who was hired to accompany this Arctic expedition in the 1920s. She became the sole survivor, living there for months. I didn't know her story, and I can't believe I didn't.
When you were editing this book, and it was published soon after the loss of your husband, Derek, did these diaries, and I know a lot of them talk about grief, the grief that women go through.
Yes.
How did that help you?
There is a kind of support in knowing that women before you have felt what you're feeling and come through it. You do just feel this strong sense of an encompassing, protective circle around you and behind you.
Sarah Griswood speaking there to Claire MacDonald. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And on Saturday, join us for The Happy Pod with Harry Bly.
Thanks, Valerie. This week, the American country singer Jordan Davis tells us about the importance of positive and uplifting news stories and his latest single, Good News Sold. In Senegal, we hear about Libraries Without Borders. They're improving educational opportunities by making online school resources available offline. A baby monkey's been born at a zoo here in Britain. He's bright orange. Find out why. And is there a doctor on board? Thankfully, seven stood up when a woman went into labour on a flight from Jordan.
Thanks, Harry. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop. The producer was Madeline Drury. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.